Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent, and as you know, I'm the author of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, and that amazing book, that wonderful book, is available to you as an audiobook, as a paperback, but the ebook, oh, esteemed audience, the ebook is free. Yes, free to download whenever you're watching or listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. Don't worry about me, I'll get your money when you come back for the sequels and some of my other books as well. And today, because my guest's newest book has been compared favorably to Watership Down and Plague Dogs by Richard Adams, I will remind esteemed audience that probably the proudest moment of my literary career, if not an event that you heard on the show, but certainly one of the top five events of my literary career, is that book, Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, was blurbed by none other than Richard Adams himself. By God, how amazing is that? And hopefully I've impressed my guest to get the conversation going. We're in good shape. For more information about all of that, including an interview with Sir Richard Adams himself, head to middlegradeninja.com. More than enough intro. My God, we've got to get started. Anthony McGowan is here. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hello, it's great to be here. And I'm amazed that you're buddies with the great Richard Adams. That's astounding. I didn't know that at all. I've now got a connection with him through you.
Exchange. I would say we absolutely are best friends for life. You have to get his take to see whether he feels the same.
I think he passed away a year or two ago, so I'm afraid we'll have to direct our thoughts upwards.
But if there is an afterlife, I'll be sure to clear my throat nervously and shake his hand and say, Mr. Adams, thank you again. You may remember, and you say, no, I'm afraid I don't, but it's lovely. So, esteemed audience knows that I never torture my guests by making them sit through me summarizing either their biography or their book, because I'll get things wrong and you'll know I got them wrong and we'll just be sitting here and it'll be awkward. So if you would give esteemed audience kind of an overview of your background and we'll go from there.
Oh, wow. Well, there's quite a lot of it because I'm so old now. But just thinking about in terms of my literary productions, my books, I was trying to count up the other day how many books I've written, and I lost count somewhere between 49 and 53. So it's somewhere in the low 50s, which is quite a lot of books. Too many books, maybe. And in that 53, I've written books for adults. I've written adult crime novels and also adult nonfiction. And I've written books for quite small children, picture books. Haven't ever quite written those books, the padded ones that toddlers wipe their drool on. But that might be my destiny one day, with a picture of a carrot on every page. But I suppose most of my books are broadly in the YA kind of area. So most of my books are aimed at teenagers. Although I've also written at least 15 books for middle grade. So there's essentially nothing I haven't stooped to in my time. It's not the kind of career I thought I would originally have. I spent a lot of time studying at college. I did various degrees. I did a PhD for a while. I always thought that my destiny would be to write, to get a job teaching in a university somewhere and maybe write one literary novel a decade. So I never quite realized I'd be a writer mainly for children, churning out book after book after book. Okay, that's me and my world.
Well, I've got you have such a fascinating background. I've got questions about your origin. Of course, we're also going to get into Dogs of the Deadlands, which is released here September 13th. Esteemed audience, you could pull up Dogs of the Deadlands while we're talking, and get your copy from the library. Order it, by God, you're not going to want to miss it. But I noticed that you had a PhD in the history of beauty. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, it was my background is basically philosophy. And so I wrote a book about the way in which philosophers and also writers wrote and thought about physical beauty, the different kind of philosophical and aesthetic ideas get built into that idea of physical attractiveness. Now, I mainly looked at literary sources. So it's a chapter on James Fenimore Cooper, the great American novelist, other chapters on Gothic fiction. And so not the kind of thing that's particularly useful, but it was a fun thing to study.
Well, I saw that and I thought, well, now if you were a cover artist, that makes 100% sense. Does that give you, if you're writing about the perception of beauty within literature, that makes more sense.
Yeah, I guess. But I, it didn't, I mainly did the PhD to get myself a job teaching universities. And I had a couple of interviews, blew the interviews, never quite got the job at a university. Ended up doing that, the kind of boring job that every teenager dreads and fears. I was actually working for the government as a civil servant in a boring office with a big pile of files and a big book of instructions. But there, I suppose, because my day job was so boring, I felt it perhaps freed up my imagination. And so that's really when I started to write creatively, when my real life was so dull. Maybe that's a common picture with authors.
There's our first tip for writers. Get the most boring possible day job you can. Your imagination will explode.
Well, I do think if you derive a lot of fulfillment from your day job, then that might suck out some of that creative energy. So if I'd had a better job, I may well never have written anything apart from the terrible adolescent poetry, which is always my first love.
Most writers have got some terrible adolescent poetry someplace. I've got a whole.
I guess we do.
It's not published. It doesn't need to be. It was enough just to have existed at the time. It's fine. So I had read that prior to 9 years old, you're not reading anything, and then a teacher gives you a copy of The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, well, it's not quite true that I didn't read anything. I was a typical horrible little boy. That what I cared about was war. And also animals. So there's my two great loves as a small kid. So I read lots of nonfiction. I've got somewhere here behind me in my bookshelf. I'll never find it. It's a book called the Guinness Book of Animal Facts and Feats, which is like, you know, the Guinness Book of Records. It's like that, but about animal stuff. So it's got the man-eating tiger that ate the most people. And it's that kind of gory fact. And so my head was full of that kind of material, but I'd never really read any fiction at all until the teacher gave me The Lord of the Rings. And it wasn't even The Hobbit, you know, it was the daddy version. And because I hadn't really read any fiction, I didn't really know what fiction was. And I had to learn to read fiction and novels through that process of reading The Lord of the Rings. It probably took me 3 years to get through it for the first time. But then for the following years, I just used to read it again and again and again until I was in my mid-teens and I moved on finally. Yeah, so that was always my kind of start in the fictional world.
So 2-3 years, it takes you to get through it, but by God, you do it. The hobbits, they eat, they walk, they eat, they walk, they sing. And this, at this point, I'm imagining you crawling and then starting to walk a little bit and then running, because somewhere in there you take off and go on and you're going to be studying the depictions of beauty within fiction and becoming a writer yourself. So when does that click? When does that switch flip for you?
Well, it's interesting. Now, obviously, there's this huge genre of YA, young adult literature, which is aimed at teenagers and those little older. But that didn't quite exist in the same way back in the 1980s when I was a teenager. So what I made the leap from books like The Lord of the Rings to the kind of adult fiction that appeals to teenagers. So science fiction, I read a lot of. Stephen King was a very important author to me in those formative teenage years. So it's also, I read Joseph Heller's Catch 22 when I was 16, which again filled my head with these comic potentialities of life. So it was more that kind of the sort of adult fiction that does appeal to teenagers was my next step after that.
Gotcha. So that captures your imagination, lights a little spark that becomes a roaring fire somewhere in there through the teenage years. That by the time you get to university, you're more or less all in. You're planning to teach and write literary novels, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Although it's I don't know, it's always tempting to try and find those roots of the current you in your past. I just don't know to what extent you could have seen me at 16 or 18 or 21 and seen the me at 57. There's so many different paths that one might have gone down in life. So I don't know. Also, he was like most adolescent boys, I was fairly, you know, in many ways appalling, selfish and egotistical and, you know, monstrous in many ways. Whereas now, as you can see, I'm a good guy. We all say that, don't we?
I think monstrous in many ways is a description that can apply to most teenage boys. Certainly me. many of the teenage boys I was friends with. So there we are. We were monsters together. It was lovely. Well, I'm reading your bio and I'm thinking, okay, well, this makes sense. You're writing your terrible poetry. You get turned on to fiction. Yep, that all seems straightforward. And then I read, nope, I was also a nightclub bouncer. That's an unusual job.
Yeah, it surprises people who meet me now. But it was when I was doing, among my degrees, I was doing a master's degree at Manchester University, a kind of gritty northern town in England, not living on very much money. And I just applied for this job at a nightclub. I didn't quite realize it was going to be a doorman. So does the term bouncer mean the same in the United States? So it means that the guy in the door.
100%. Here, it's a tough guy that will throw you out of the club if you're misbehaving.
Yeah, that was me, yes. And I was never that tough, but I was quite, you know, quite tall and quite, in those days, quite kind of ripped. Can I say that? So I applied for this job, and it was that the salary back then was £10 an hour. This is back in the late 1980s. Which even now is not it's now the minimum wage in the UK is about £10 an hour. So it was riches back then. And also the day after I joined as a sort of most lowly bouncer, all the other doormen in the place were headhunted by a better club just a bit further down the street. So I became the head doorman. So I got even more money. I was up to £15 an hour there. But also I didn't have to do very much actual brutalization of the customers. I had my guys I could send in to do the beating up. So that was all quite good as well. But yeah, I was never a particularly convincing bouncer, I have to say that.
Well, I imagine in some nights you come in, you got an extra bit of extra aggression. Like, you know what? Stand down, I'll handle this one.
maybe.
And then something you've been very public about and written about, so I feel it's fair to ask about, is that 1986, at 21, you get diagnosed with testicular cancer. You're told your chance of survival is in the low teens. And of course, I'm talking to you now at 57. So we know that was not the best.
Yeah, I made it. But also even then, that was slightly out of date because my best friend was a medical student. And so when I got my diagnosis, the first thing we did was to look it up in his medical textbook, which was just a couple of years out of date, because just around then there was a whole new family of drugs that they found, which almost in every case cures testicular cancer. Now, I was always, luckily, I didn't need the drugs. My cancer hadn't spread. So I was always in that 10% that would always have pulled through. But still, it's quite a bleak moment to come across. I suppose at the time, it didn't feel like it affected me that badly. I obviously didn't want to die. I liked being alive. But it just seemed to be, you kind of got through day by day. It was only sort of looking back on it years later that I suddenly felt the weight of it. I got through. Here I am, as you said.
Well, I like to imagine a moment like that, because later I know that you're going to go on to have a novel rejected widely and probably have some moments of darkness and despair. The wonderful world of being an author. But you're going to have that. And I imagine that's almost got a pale in comparison, and you've got some perspective on that once you've looked death in the eye.
I guess. Although maybe I was saved by my lack of depth, my superficiality meant it didn't impact me too deeply. But I suppose, there is a serious message here, which is it's one of the few cancers that young men get. On the whole, we don't get cancer. And if you find it early enough, it's 100% treatable. You know, it's not even just that you slightly improve your chances, that they cure it. So the key thing is to, you know, adolescent boys out there, well, get some proper advice about how to do this, but check yourselves. It's a really important thing.
I love that. Didn't have the depth to properly appreciate it. Sorry. And then here is something that caught my eye, because I'm happily married. I know you are as well. Well, I know you're married. I assume happily. But I'm reading about you, and you've got your first book, Abandoned Hope, is out there, and it's being rejected. But your wife has written a successful novel about the fashion industry. She's only got an agent. What kind of impact does that have on an American publication?
It was a very, very strange time. Now, I've got to say that I helped her a lot with that novel, but it's her book. All of our friends knew that I was the aspiring writer. She was a successful fashion designer. And yet suddenly out of the blue, she gets published and I don't. So it did make me appear like a massive loser in the eyes of the world, quite rightly, as I was. But because I suppose that her book was almost a collaboration between the two of us, so it's fine in terms of the dynamic of our relationship. But it did, I suppose, in the world, it set us off. She's this glorious, beautiful, blonde, successful person, and I'm the hopeless loser in the corner. But then, fortunately, it wasn't too long before I got published as well, which kind of saved the day from my point of view. And in fact, I only got published because she did, in a way, because I sent out my book. It was eventually published as Hellbent, it got the first round universally rejected, not even personalized rejections. It was more, dear sir, stroke madam, your book, stroke play, stroke poetry collection. So just, you know, delete as necessary. But then she got an agent and got published straight away, and her agent took pity on me and took me on as well. But actually, even the agent, who's a brilliant agent with William Morris, called Stephanie Cabot, she couldn't sell Hellbent. I mean, Hellbent's a very strange book. It's about a teenage boy who dies and goes to hell. And it's about his adventures in hell and his memories of being back on Earth. And it's a very, very scatological book. It's got lots of what I would call body comedy in it. It's a comedy about hell, essentially, but a kind of gory, filthy book. But it's also a retelling of Dante's Inferno. So it's quite a hard sell. And even with this brilliant agent on board, she couldn't get the publishers to accept it. It was just, it's like nothing else ever written, I think. That sounds like a bit of a kind of a boast there, but there are no other children's books or YA books like Hellbent. But so she suggests that I write something more commercial. So then I wrote a couple of adult thrillers, first one called Stag Hunt, second one called Mortal Coil, and they got published more or less based on the synopsis. So that kind of pulled me out of that dark place. And then because I was suddenly now a published author, rather than this total outsider loser, then other publishers suddenly wanted Hellbent. So I'm just thinking about your listeners, those who are writers out there. It'd be very hard to follow my path into publication. And it's always incredibly difficult and strange, and you need that coin to come up on the right side a few times. But here it was because, you know, I was a failed writer. My wife got published. My wife's agent took me on. She suggested I write something more commercial, and all this, you know, series of bits of good fortune had the final result of me becoming eventually a YA writer. That was a really muddled explanation of my career in early career there.
Well, I wouldn't have asked you about it if it just happened a couple of years ago. I know it has a happy ending.
I guess you
won multiple.
Yeah.
I do wonder. I love your characterization of yourself as the sad loser and your wife's shadow. And I can't imagine, you're a former bouncer at that point. I can't imagine anyone making those comments to your face.
Oh no, I'm in the flesh. I'm very gentle. I'm a wimp.
So you go on to great success with Stag Hunt, and then eventually Abandoned Hope gets a title change. It comes out for the YA market. When do you feel that the hankering or the desire to write for younger readers?
I never had a desire to write for younger readers. So when I wrote that first draft of Hellbent, when it was still Abandoned Hope, the main character is 16, but the book itself was in my head. Well, you know, I think I'd heard the term YA, but I thought young adults were people like me in their 20s. I didn't realise that young adults were in fact teenagers. So I wrote it thinking it was for adults. And it was only later on talking to my agent that I realized I could take out some of the profanity and sort of resituate it as a book more for teenagers. So can I just double check. So in the US as well, is YA essentially a synonym for teenage books, or is it wider than that?
Well, technically it's a synonym for teenage books, but I think the market is a little bit wider. Certainly I'm reading them, sure, as our other. Okay. And we have our new adult, which is its own separate thing.
Oh, sure. I did a talk a couple of years ago at the Edinburgh Book Festival, big kind of festival here in the United Kingdom, where there'd just been some research showing that most YA in the UK was bought by women who were older than the age of 25. And I thought this was a little bit unsettling, because you had a big part of what was meant to be children's publishing being read and therefore directed towards adults. And so I did a talk at the Edinburgh Festival, which became somewhat controversial. I think it's online somewhere. I got quite a lot of hate back about that. because people who love YA, they really love YA. And often that's adults who are passionate about it. And they didn't like, but they thought somehow I was denigrating them or YA by saying they shouldn't read it. I don't know. So anyway, yeah. So, but Hellbent is, is a book, I think, aimed at teenagers. I mean, adults have read it, but it's really a book trying to make teenage boys laugh and to gross them out. Although the other thing that I learned after I wrote it was that, of course, teenage boys don't read at all, or lots of them don't read. So most of the readers of my YA are, in fact, girls, often 12-year-old girls who read everything. So again, it's something I didn't quite know until I became part of this wonderful world of literature that we're in now, you and I.
So does that change your perspective a bit when you write your next YA?
So I suppose that my way of answering that is to say that my way into nearly all my YA books is through a first-person narrator. And that first-person narrator is always a teenage boy in my YA books. So that means it's always got that kind of colour to it. It's a teenage boy's worldview. And that's for various reasons. Partly I do a first-person narrator to make sure I'm using the same sort of language that's appropriate to my readers, because it's their voice. Also, I was a teenage boy, obviously, and I'm guessing for many of us grown-ups now, that those were my most vivid years. And lots of things happened to me then that burnt into my memory, and it's very easy for me to access that world of the teenage boy. Almost more easy than to access the world of the adult man. I've written books from the perspective of a teenage boy. I've written books from the perspective of an adult man, because I am one. I've also written books from the perspective or from the point of view of an adult female, because most of my friends are adult females, so I can quite easily, again, get into their heads. But I was never a teenage girl. And apart from my daughter, Rosie, I've never known any teenage girls. Teenage girls always terrified me and mystified me and perplexed me. So I could never write a book from the point of view of a teenage girl. But hopefully my books are interesting to teenage girls, because it helps them to access the inside of a teenage boy's mind. Horrible place that it is.
Yes, we wouldn't want them to miss out on that. I did find it amusing, because I know the same thing happens to a lot of authors, that this is a book that has, like you say, bodily humor, that has some relatively gross stuff in it, because of course you're touring hell, of course. Mm-hmm. And you're also writing about your own traumatic experiences of being flat out, we would call it, abused at this point during your schooling years, right? Because you had people physically striking you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I went to a very, very tough high school. So I was brought up in the north of England, which in a kind of industrial city called Leeds for the most part, although actually was most of my childhood was in a small town outside Leeds. But I went to school in Leeds, this big, I'm trying to think of a city, somewhere like Pittsburgh, perhaps, a kind of industrial city. And the school I went to was one of the toughest schools in the whole of this very tough town. So there's an awful lot of kind of bullying, lots of violence in the air, fights every single break time. And the way the teachers kept control back in those days was also with brutality, lots of corporal punishment in my school. But it was a very, very interesting, inverted commas, kind of place. But I actually didn't have a bad time at that school. I loved that school, because although there was violence all around, it never really dragged me down, because I was quite a big guy and I was good at sports. So even though in some ways I should have been bullied mercilessly, because I was just from out of town, so I was geographically an outsider, I obviously liked learning things. So I was one of the kids whose hand was always up in class, sir, miss, answering questions. And also, I suppose, compared to some of the other kids there, I was quite middle class, because it was in the middle of this very poor housing estate around it. Now, my parents were both nurses, so not particularly posh, as we'd say, at all. But compared to the poor local kids, quite, almost aristocratic. So these kind of three this kind of triple outsider status should have made me a victim. But as I say, I was good at sports, and that took me out of the bullying zone. And so all around me, there was this madness, this chaos, this danger. But I loved it. I surfed it. It was a wave I surfed. So yeah, the memories got burnt in, but they didn't burn me in the sense of damaging me, I don't think. Although we never really know, do we? Maybe I am damaged by it all.
Well, I mean, it's worked out for you, so it may not be advisable, but you've certainly shattered into a successful career. What struck me with people reacting to Hellbound was that you have this book with literally set in hell, with all of this occurring, and people are not people, some adults are up in arms about the profanity in the book.
Yeah.
Which still amuses me and also frustrates me, because of course a teenager who could endure all of that profanity is the least of their worries, especially in canon in a book, right?
Exactly. You know, the book, although it has lots of body comedy and the language is as you say, quite profane, it's got a moral core. You know, the kind of hidden narrative is that my main character, Connor, trying to find out why he, a relatively normal kid, has been sent to hell. And so there's long debates about the nature of good and evil and morality. So it's meant to be a moral book, just one with lots of dirty jokes in it. And also, as you suggest there, that... you know, I do worry about the amount of violence in our society, and the kind of graphic imagery that teenagers have access to all the time, in a way that people of my generation didn't. But I do think that the stuff you can find online can be corrosive to those young souls. But I don't think literature ever can be. It's just a different sort of experience to read a book than to be confronted with some terrible graphic video. So, you know, I did actually write a column years ago for the Guardian newspaper in the UK about would I ban any books? We're literary people, so I'm guessing that you wouldn't want to ban any books. But I did possibly contemplate a couple that I might ban. I don't know about that in the States, but in the UK, if you get a serial killer in the UK, they only ever read two books. They read the Marquis de Sade and they read Nietzsche. because if you're that way inclined, then you can find what you want in Nietzsche and the Marquis de Sade. So if I was going to ban anything, I would ban those, but I wouldn't ban those at all because I don't believe in banning books. But no, certainly not my relatively harmless YA. I don't think it can corrode the soul of a young person.
Generally speaking, I'm against book banning, but if we're talking about the collected works of Ayn Rand, I'm open.
I'd high five you there if we were in the same room.
My worry with that is if we ban her book, somebody who's just a little bit more clever, a little bit more insidious, would write those same philosophies in a way that's slightly less laughable. Because I thought they were comedy at one point, and then I realized that so many here, at least in America, like Alan Greenspan and others, have been in charge of our economy. Oh, they took her serious. Oh my God. Oh no. But I worry that if somebody were to write some of those same philosophies more clever, then it wouldn't have the same inoculation effect that hopefully if somebody reads Atlas Shrugged at age 17 and becomes a jerk for a while, but has that theory shot down, like, oh, okay, well, now I'm immune to that same silliness creeping in again.
Also, if you ban books, they become more alluring to some people. So, you know, the fact that they're forbidden makes you want to explore them. So maybe I wish I was more banned so the kids would seek me out.
Well, here's hoping. Just stick with the profanity.
The books I've written for sort of 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds and the mid-grade books don't have any profanity in. Just to clarify that, it's only my high-end YA books that are full of filth.
Very true. In fact, you know what? I've got more questions for you about some of your middle grade books, but let's dig right in and let's talk about the new one, Dogs of the Deadlands, which just released here September 13th, as you're listening to us, esteemed audience. True to my word, I will not make you sit through me summarizing your book to you and getting it wrong. So what does esteemed audience need to know about Dogs of the Deadlands?
Okay. I mean, can I hold it up to the microphone here? Will that be useful? It's the book begins in 1986. when, as I'm sure your listeners know, there was this terrible explosion in the Chernobyl nuclear plant in what is now Ukraine, but was the Soviet Union. And so this big explosion, it contaminated the local area with radioactivity. And so the people had to be evacuated, but they weren't allowed to take their animals with them. They were told they'd be coming back in a few days. And so there's a kind of human main character in the story who's, it's her sixth birthday on the day that the plant blows up. And she's been given a pup for her birthday, a Samoyed puppy, which may have a little bit of wolf in it, but she has to leave her little dog behind her. It's a slightly heartbreaking scene when she has to let go of the dog. So that's a kind of human story, then follows Natasha through her life, and she's blighted by this experience. She's got this hole in her core, left by this absence of this beautiful puppy. But the main narrative follows two generations of dogs who are interacting with the local wildlife. So when the people moved out of that area, the whole area was rewilded. So the people moved out and the big fauna came back in. So bison, moose, wolves, most famously lynx and bear, all came back into these now abandoned forests. And my story is about how these feral dogs interact with the wolves. And it's sort of two generations of the dogs. You do find out in the end that one generation, the older, the mother is the puppy Zoya that Natasha left behind. Although the main narrative is about her offspring. She's got two dogs, two puppies called Misha and Bratan. And it's about their struggles to survive in this incredible wilderness. And the kind of core of it is about how they try and survive against the dogs are kind of the good guys in the book, and the bad guys to begin with are the wolves. So I did lots of research about about how feral dogs survive in the wild, but also about wolf and dog interaction. Also lots of research about the wolves themselves trying to get it all right. And so from the point of view of the dogs, the wolves are the bad guys. And a lot of the research I went into was fairly grim. So I didn't quite realize this, but well, you know that wolves and dogs are basically the same species. Genetically, they're pretty much identical. They can fully interbreed, have fertile offspring. But wolves have got dogs have lost a lot of those adaptations that wolves have had. So they're weaker, their bite strength isn't anywhere like a wolf. And also in wolf packs, the males play a full role in looking after the puppies, whereas dogs, even wild dogs and males, don't play any kind of role. So there's all these adaptations for the wild that the dogs have lost. And generally speaking, when a dog and a wolf meet in the wild, it's only got one outcome, which is that within seconds, often within 5 seconds, the wolf has killed the dog, and then they eat him. and the only way in which this doesn't end up badly for the dog is if it's I'm trying to think of the best way to put it, if it's a lady dog and it's a daddy wolf, and they become romantically attached. That's the one time the wolf will not kill the dog. So that's a lot of the kind of background to it. And so the second generation of dogs that we follow in the story are half wolf, and it's about their struggles to survive. That was you did a better job of trying to explain what my book was about, but that's basically it in a big cloud. And then so the two storylines finally come back together again when Natasha is reunited with one of the dogs, without giving too much away. Did that make sense?
It's an expansive story, so I'm impressed by the attempt to...
It was terrible. So I sometimes do, big influence in this book was The Call of the Wild by Jack London. Brilliant book, again, about dogs and wolves interacting. And I sometimes say this is like Call of the Wild meets War and Peace by Tolstoy, just given that I've got this huge cast of characters and this Russian background there.
So you mentioned you're a teenager in the 80s. I'm assuming the explosion of Chernobyl catches your imagination just like the rest of the world.
Yeah, well, it happened when I was actually at university. So I was 21 at the time. And I had one of my friends was studying Russian in Kiev, which was the nearest big town to Chernobyl. And so she had to be evacuated. So it was it had a big impact on me then. You know, it was that kind of big event. Also, it came at a time when, still the Cold War was in full spate, and so that nuclear terror that maybe has been, you know, that specter's rising again because of the awful situation in Ukraine now. But that was all the background to that, and then this nuclear disaster. So yeah, it was a really, in many ways, a hot topic back then.
And so has this been sort of in the back of your mind that sooner or later I'm going to write about the disaster, or?
No, it wasn't in that way. But once the disaster happened, then you got all this really intriguing stuff to do with the ecology of the place. And because I've always, going back to my early interest in the natural world, so that was always my kind of main focus. I saw a couple of brilliant National Geographic documentaries about this rewilding of the area, and about the reappearance of the wolves. And so that was, I don't know, that's what really triggered me. There was one amazing scene I saw where there was this wolf pack in the foreground. In the background, you had the ruined nuclear plant. It just seemed to be a really striking image. And I thought, there's a story in this. Then there was a different National Geographic story about the surviving dogs. So the pets that were abandoned, most of them just died. But the very few that survived by hanging around the nuclear plant where there were still workmen there. And so it's a program about those surviving dogs as well. And I brought the two things together.
Gotcha. So you see that image and that's in your head for years, months?
Years, yeah. A long gestation period.
Always fascinated by how long an author's gestation period takes, how that kernel eventually becomes the full tree.
Yeah, well, I don't know about you, but part of the thing about being a children's writer is that you have an obligation, I think, to keep on churning out the books. Because if if you're writing for, say, 13-year-olds, and you take 5 years over a book, then your 13-year-olds are 18; they're too old to read your book. So I do feel this pressure to produce, and so I've often got two or three books on the go at the same time. There'll be the one that I'm actually writing. Then in the back of my mind, there'll be the one that is gestating, to use that word again. And so this one was gestating for a long time. Probably I wrote 10 books while I was still thinking, sometimes subconsciously, about Dogs in the Deadlands.
Gotcha. And then you have said that this book, Dogs of the Deadlands, has been your biggest ever writing challenge. I'm assuming until the next one, but as of your writing,
I will never write a book like this again. It's been too much of a challenge. It's broken me.
how did it break you? What was so challenging?
Well, okay. Partly, my muddled explanation of the story earlier, I might give an indication. There's a lot happening in this story. The two different storylines of the dogs and the human, just that was quite hard to encompass. But just purely the timeline was fantastically complicated, trying to get a human growing from childhood to adulthood and the two generations of the dogs. It was just viciously complicated. And I know there's different types of writers. There are the planners, and then there are the pantsers, is the term that I've heard. People just do it by the seat of their pants. But I always, historically, I've had an idea for a story and I've just started writing it. And I don't do any planning at all. I know roughly the shape of it, but I just start typing. And basically I write the first draft. And that's kind of what gets published. But with this, I had to really plot it out in intense detail. So with the post-it notes all over the wall and different apps I tried to help me plan it. And it was still really hard to make those two timelines work. I had to do a little bit of stretching and compressing. So that was it was a kind of intellectual challenge that was different to my normal writing challenge, which is just to find the best words for my ideas. Here it was logistical almost. and it was just really, really hard. And so this book went through as well many more drafts than most of my books. I mean, usually when I finish my first draft, what's published is 99% the same, with a few corrections. Whereas this, the first draft, was probably only 50% there. It was just a terrible, terrible mess. And also there were even more digressions, huge great bubbles that came off from the main storyline. Which I don't know if you find that, and some of your writer listeners, but often the digressive bits were some of the best writing. But because they didn't work to move the plot forward, they had to be cut away, which is always brutal and hurts, killing your darlings.
Do you save your darlings for use elsewhere, or at least maybe they'll be used?
The two big bits that had to go were, it's a whole self-contained bit set in the Second World War about the partisans and the Germans fighting in the same around the same area, which also involved wolves, and another part set during the Afghan war, so that they are, I'm going to try and do something with them, or is that too cynical? But I hate wasting words. Did you hate the whole idea of spending an hour of your life writing a perfect sentence and then for it to never be used is heartbreaking.
My longest novel never got published, but it did get farmed out and became three other novels. So that's fine.
Okay.
parts of it got reused. Parts of it were beyond redemption and they sit on the hard drive where they belong. And then a pile of darlings I've cut for manuscripts with the promise that one day this will be useful to you. And most of the time it's not, but I feel so much better. It's not gone. It still exists. I didn't waste my time. And I did. Because writing those darlings enables you to finish the overall narrative. And however it gets there, if you get there, that's victory, right?
Yeah, true. But maybe because of my lower middle class background, I have a hatred of waste. So I had a sudden memory then of my dad. Basically, all his meals were made from the leftovers from all our one of five children. So he just literally scraped all our leftovers onto his plate, and that was his dinner. And I actually found that when my children were younger, I did that as well. I literally inherited that habit of just eating leftovers, almost the garbage. And I think about writing as a similar process of eating it. No, that's a terrible metaphor. It's not like that at all. But I still hate waste.
You know, I wondered about that because I saw that you described yourself as being very working class, and one of five children as a child. Then I saw both your parents are nurses. And here in America, where we do medicine for profit, if you can't afford it, you die. That's how we do it here. A nurse is actually a pretty good position. You could have a nice house. You could have, maybe seven children. Yeah. All right. Was that just a different situation?
Different. So, but even though it's quite interesting. So brief tangent here. There's almost a cliche that writers often inhabit this sort of liminal space in between different worlds. And that's certainly true about me, both sort of geographically. I was brought up in the north of England. I now live in the south in London. So I'm split in a, I went to school in the big city, but my home was in a small town. So I had a bit of kind of rural and urban kind of thing going on. But also in the UK, exactly at that kind of interface between working class and lower middle class. So I span both of those kind of worlds. But I mean, definitely here, well, nurses were not very well paid, but they had a big pension. So you kind of you scrape by when you were working, but afterwards when you retired, then it was relatively easy. But also my mum and my dad both come from families where lots of them, but their siblings were nurses. And many of them moved to America. And became nurses in the States or Canada, where exactly as you say, they simply had a much better standard of living, much better life. There you go.
I still got nurses while you're working. Then when you retire, it's all stakes. Right?
I was trying to. It's like trying to remember how many books I've written. I was trying to count up my cousins, and I've got over 50 first cousins. And I think probably 25 of those are scattered around America and Canada. So I do feel linked with your glorious country for all its faults.
I criticize it because I love it. And
of course, of course.
You'll visit the cousins, you'll do the book tour, you'll be around, it'll be a good time. So, I wanted to talk a bit about your writing process with the time that we have left. So maybe this is a bad book to take as typical, but you say you at any given time, you've got about three books that you're working on. So what does your writing day look like? Of those three projects, which one do you delve into, or do you work a little bit on all three throughout the day?
I tend to have one that I'm focusing on and then one that I'm, that's so again, that. I was slightly misleading there when I was saying I'm working on several at the same time. So several out in a year. So I'll go straight from one project onto the next rather than literally writing them all at the same time. I just don't think I could do that. So I'll have one my every day, one that I'm thinking about in the back of my mind, and then the one before that, and the one after that will have, you know, be kind of crammed together. But this room here that we're in, it's the smallest room in our apartment. It used to be my daughter's bedroom, but when, you know, the whole kind of, but my wife got my study, I got the smallest room. So I don't really like working here. But when I can, I go to work in the British Library, which is the beautiful big library in London here, which feels like the kind of place where creative acts get done. So it's a wonderful place to work. So I try to almost in the sense of like going to an office, I try to go there most days, bring my computer, my packed lunch, and I work. And if I spend a day there, I'll write always a minimum of 1,000 words. And I feel that's kind of basically my day done. On good days, I might write 3,000. Bad days, sometimes nothing comes out, as you know. I've kind of avoided the question about process by talking about location. So for me, the most important thing is to get there in this almost neutral space, with my computer open, and make my fingers stop, and then it kind of happens. That's a terrible description of writing, wasn't it?
Public space. Somebody probably recognizes you and says, "Oh, that's Tony." I should go talk to him. Last book.
I
love to read, and there's an author. So
I dream of being recognized. No, I'm not that kind. I've got quite a few friends that work in the British Library as well, so they recognize me most of the time. But I'm afraid I'm not quite J.K. Rowling. I'm not quite recognizable in that sense.
Good. Apparently, that kind of success can lead to monstrousness. And now I've alienated our British listeners. I apologize, J.K. Rowling. I've got my Harry Potter figurines right up here. I love Harry Potter.
All right. Yes.
I see. Robert Gilbert's pretty good, too.
What's pretty good too?
The book, I hear bad things. Maybe I'll get to it. Maybe I won't. The criticizing the internet. Building. What are you doing? But we were talking about you there in the library. You're working, so you pop in earbuds and block out the world, or do you want to hear people looking for and shopping?
Sometimes. I mean, what I tend to do is I will have a burst of creativity. That might take half an hour, then I'll sit back and look at the world. So the beautiful thing about this library is it's a huge place. There's always something interesting to look at if you want to. It's full of kind of eccentric old researchers with cleaning their ears with tissue or blowing their nose and looking at it or staggering around. So kind of quasi-tramp-like people, as well as kind of young people there studying. So there's something to just divert the eye for a minute, and then you get back into the work again. So it tends to be that oscillation between the intense, frenzied, only I type with two fingers, kind of a learn to touch type, pounding away and then relaxing for a while, looking at the world, spending a lot of time thinking about my packed lunch at lunchtime. So I got in the courtyard, and you know how you get when you kind of get slightly bored when you're working sometimes, and so your lunch acquires a special importance to you. So that's a thing.
Sure. Maybe you got a bunch of words that day. Maybe you got none, but by God, lunch will happen at the appointed time. two fingers, huh? You said almost 40, 49, almost 50 books now?
You know, after I finish each book, I think, okay, I'm going to use the next little space, free time, to learn how to touch type. And I just never do. I think I'm too old now. It's also I make a terrible, really often people ask me to be quiet. I'm just typing too loudly with my two fingers. But it would be much better. Are you a proper touch typist?
Yeah.
It's insane. It's almost, I reckon, my top tip for writers: learn to touch type. Your life will be so much easier.
I had to think for a moment there. Do I want to hold myself up as a hallmark of great typing? No, but can I do it? Yes.
Well, listen, so
you've got to be faster with two fingers.
It's a slightly boring point there, but when you're touch typing, you're looking at the screen, so you're seeing the words emerge. Whereas I'm just looking at my keyboard. So often you look up and suddenly you find you've had the caps lock on, and so you've got to get rid of it. You know, it's all in capitals, or just you've written gibberish. Autocorrect has changed it to something that you didn't really want. So it's just a laborious thing then to go back and have to edit your poor typing. So yeah, learn to touch type, guys. That's what I would recommend. And you know what? I'm gonna learn. If you talk to me in a year about my next book, I promise I will have learned to touch type. Are you happy now?
No, I'm not. You're gonna sit down and you're not gonna be able to write a word. I will have disrupted your entire process. Don't do it. This is working. Stick with what's working. No, I frequently joke on the show, as soon as I have two successful authors telling me we do the exact same thing the same way every time and we're always successful, I'm throwing out everything I do and I'm doing that. But it hasn't happened yet. So this is your way to be successful. So does have you tried writing by hand? Does that speed the process?
No, I just don't think I've got the motor skills anymore. You know, occasionally I'll do events where I'm going to sign 50 books or so. And at the end of that, my whole arm swells up. I couldn't write a book with a pen these days. I don't know any writers of my generation that use a pen and paper anymore. I don't think. I don't even make. I've got a little notebook, but. Even notes, I tend to use a computer. But I was kind of pondering my process. I tried to work out what it is. I suppose what normally happens with most of my books is that I get a little flash. So with Hellbent, just a little idea was teenage boy dies and goes to hell. And then the book is, and everything I need is contained in that seed. And just the writing is just essentially expanding on that initial idea, and that's all I need. And it's basically then just a matter of me literally starting the beginning and typing out that story. Or my absolute favorite book that I wrote a book called Hello Darkness, which is about a teenage boys at school where they have animals, like school pets, and the school pets are being murdered one by one, and my narrator Johnny's always around when the school pets being murdered. So he gets the blame for it. He's got to find out who's really killing the school pets. And about halfway through the story, you realize that he's stopped taking his medication. So he's got quite severe mental illness. And from that point on, you don't quite know what's really happening in the school and what's happening in his imagination. it's a pastiche of noir fiction. But also a story about mental illness. And so there again, the initial seed was just this, almost a line in my head, he stopped taking his medication. And then the rest of the story kind of fell into place around that. So that's my normal process, is that little idea that somehow has within it both the characters and the world and the plot. And writing is just after that, almost dictation for me. That makes sense?
It does. Thinking about characters and here recently on online, which sometimes feels like real life but isn't, but it seems like there's been an overwhelming emphasis on authenticity, on writing only a character that could possibly be you, which how boring. Esteemed audience, terrible. I've seen everything interesting in my life on this show. I don't have anything else. But you have written about a character with mental illness. You've written about an obese teen who goes to Vatso camp, a whole trilogy. And based on our conversation, I'm assuming that you don't have much experience having been obese. What was your poor father have? There'd be no leftovers.
Well, you know, I became relatively obese in my old age. I'm actually on a pretty rigorous diet. I suddenly hit 100 kilograms, what would that be in American money? Overweight. And so I've been trying to trim down a bit. I suddenly found that I didn't fit any of my trousers anymore. So it's economical thing. I had either buy new trousers or lose a few pounds. So we've done that route. But so no, I suppose what I, most of my characters, as I say, are kind of first person, most of my books, first person narratives. And as long as I can get into that head, then I'm fine. But I think I do need, I completely take your point about the glory of writing diverse characters. But for me, kind of a Venn diagram-like effect, I need some connection with me. So yeah, I wrote about an obese teenager, but there was enough of an overlap with my own world for that to be fine. I can make the small leap then into that obesity. Same with mental illness. you know, I don't have paranoid schizophrenia, but like many of us, I've struggled with mental health in my life. So there's enough overlap there to make that connection. But also, as well as being a teenager with mental health issues, he's still a teenage boy. So there's enough of that core there as well. So for me personally, because of that whole way into the book and me writing first person narratives, I think I do feel I need a connection. So I don't think I could write about a black kid in a city, London. It's just, you know, being brought up now. I just haven't got that overlap with that character. Now, I'm delighted for other people to do that. But for me, I need a tether between me and that character. But, you know, but I have written from a female point of view. And I've written from many animal points of view.
That is interesting. Thinking from the perspective of a wolf.
Yeah.
You have your dog there at the house. I'm assuming you do obviously lots of research, but how do you put yourself in the head of, I mean, obviously, ultimately, this is a book that's going to be enjoyed by humans. If you could actually communicate with a wolf, they might read your book and go, no, that's not it at all. Fortunately, since that's not a possibility. How do you get yourself in the head of a wolf character?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, in the whole, I mean, this is partly in the broad genre of animal fantasy. And within that broad genre, you've got books like Call of the Wild, where the animals are depicted realistically. Then you have books like Watership Down, where you know, it's rabbits, but they basically speak like people. or a book like Warhorse by Michael Morpurgo, it's a book I particularly dislike. Is Morpurgo a big writer in America? Or he's huge here?
I haven't read him.
Okay, it's huge here. But anyway, his animals are like Socrates. They're almost infinitely wise and eloquent. So there's that genre of animal fantasy where the animals are kind of people. And then you've got the Call of the Wild where the animals are realistically depicted. This book's much nearer to the Call of the Wild. So it's not a first-person narrative from in the head of the dogs, but it's a close third person. So I follow the dogs very closely. And they don't speak. Other than occasionally I'll translate a bit of dog language into human words. So a word like, you know, stay or no or danger. but they don't speak eloquently, you know, in philosophical kind of terms, the way that some authors have their animals speak and think. So to get into that world, I did a vast amount of really interesting research about the world of dogs and wolves, about the language, about the pack interaction, and I really enjoyed that part, that aspect of the research. It was fascinating. Plus, I have a dog, and you know, we you love your animal, and you kind of in some ways anthropomorphize them, but occasionally you take a step back and study them as animals and watch the exact kind of the interactions between dogs and the different types of body language. So a lot of that went into the book as well. So I suppose it's the way I got into the head of the dog was by very closely examining the outside of the dog. So looking at their behavior rather than trying to get their mental processes. But also, having said that, I've tried to avoid anthropomorphizing them. At the same time, there are human elements to their thought processes. I want the readers to feel very close to these canine characters. And that does involve, to an extent, making them slightly more human than perhaps nature would allow.
One of the best pieces of advice I ever got about writing animal characters or any animal character or any type of character that's not human was from science fiction author Hugh Howey. Been on the show twice, esteemed audience. Go check the back end one. But he talked about writing about aliens, and he said there's a danger in making them so alien that we can't relate to them. And since the aliens, so far as we know, aren't reading the book, we better concentrate on our primary.
That's great advice, yeah. But also, I suppose as I said, to begin with, the wolves are the bad guys here. I mean, later on, there's a kind of coming together of the wolves and the dogs, and so you see it more from their point of view. But you know, often, certainly in Europe, I'm guessing in America as well, is a tendency to romanticize wolves because they are this incredibly impressive species, intelligent, complex, a really keystone species in lots of environments. But the life of the wolf is brutal. You know, the commonest way for a wolf to die is to be killed by other wolves, killed and generally eaten. So wolf packs can be brutal places. And so I did want to get some of that brutality and that nature, red in tooth and claw aspect into the book as well. I'm sure I had another point there. What was I trying to say? About how, the wolves to begin with are very much the other. Whereas the dogs are kind of the us in that world.
Of course, I know because I listened to you talk to the BBC that you believe that we're all kind of the villains sometimes, right?
Yeah, well, there's clearly that huge impulse that we have to see ourselves as the heroes of our own narrative. And that hero figure for most of us is going to be a goodie, and so we tend to only really see our good points and are blind to our bad points, and also the fact that in our narrative, those who get in our way, we tend to see them as being the baddies, the antagonists, and in some way contaminated by the kind of evil that's the opposite of our good. But I do think if you objectively look at our own lives, there comes a moment when you can stand away from that worldview in which you're the hero and see yourself in your true light. And it's not always flattering. So, yeah, I did think about two or three occasions in my own life where I was the bad guy. I'm thinking more about when I was a teenager in that relatively brutal school environment. Looking back now, I feel nothing but shame. Now, I suppose I mean, there's two or three events, one of which I talked about in that that BBC talk. Where looking back now, I'm almost thinking that maybe part of my literary impulse has been to atone for some of those sins. So a lot of my books focus on bullying and power relations in school. And trying to find a way out of those confrontational situations. And maybe it is a sense of shame about the fact that some of the things that I did, actually even more than things I personally did, one of the reasons I feel really strongly about this is that I wasn't really bullied at my school, but I didn't quite have enough status or strength of character or courage to stand up for the other kids who were bullied. And it was happening all around me. I never quite made that sacrifice or that commitment to try and help others. And now it's my biggest regret in my life that I never quite had that genuine heroism to step in back then. Have I revealed too much?
I'll bring my rationalization and you tell me why it's a bad fig leaf. But I think of some things that I did when I was younger that I'm not particularly proud of. I think, well, one, I think anytime I imagine I find the person who I think I've wronged and I say, this is the worst thing I ever did, and I apologize, I always imagine there's somebody else standing right behind me watching this in horror saying, you think that's the worst thing I ever did? The thing you did to me, oh my God. But I also imagine that if you grow up, one, your brain's not fully formed in your teenage years, you haven't had the life experiences that you do have now looking back and realizing all the things that had to happen. And also the world has changed dramatically in some ways, just in the access to information that we have now, the easier way it is to see true north. So when I look back and I think, well, that was a decision clearly made out of ignorance, but is it a decision that was made by the vast majority of people in that same circumstance at that time? Yes, it was. Does that make it right? No. But do I get a little bit of leeway for not being the one perfect person that stood up against the massive onslaught? Or is that a bad rationalization and I just need to do my best to make up for it going forward?
Wise words, either way. Yeah, no, that's a brilliant way to look at it. I suppose linking it back to my dogs and my wolves, maybe another reason why I was drawn to writing YA and setting books in particular in that school environment is that they're, from the point of view, from your point of view, the bullies are the bad guys, almost in a kind of, you know, the cowboy in the black hat kind of sense, obvious. And that's quite a powerful thing to get in a narrative. But also what I try to do in a lot of my books is to show that, so from the point of view of the bully person, the bully is straightforwardly evil, but trying then to get an understanding later on about what made that bully the person he or she is. And then perhaps you get a kind of a thesis, antithesis, synthesis kind of thing going on there that comes to be some kind of understanding. Because now as an adult, I obviously know that that if you've got a kid behaving badly at school, it's almost certainly because they're the product of these terrible events in their own life, the things that formed and shaped them. You know, but if you're some poor little 12-year-old nerd getting the heck kicked out of them by a bigger kid, you don't think about that. But in fact, that's the kind of broader reality there. So I have tried to get that broader understanding into a lot of my books.
It's a forever gray area, I feel, and you would know better than I with your background in philosophy, because, of course, if we go too far, well, can't we ever hold anybody accountable for anything? It's all society.
Yeah. Well, it's, that's another whole podcast about the nature of free will and ethics, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to solve it all right here today. Knock that out. Well, esteemed audience has patiently waited because they know I ask every guest who comes on the show, and I wouldn't disappoint them. Have you ever seen a ghost and or a flying saucer?
Oh, that's a great question. No, to both. and I'm I suppose I am a rationalist to my core. But I want there to be ghosts, because if there really are ghosts, everything's possible. So I hope that one day I will. I suppose that there are ghosts in that our lives are often haunted by people who are gone, in that metaphorical sense. You know, I lost both my parents over the past couple of years, and yet their presences are still real to me. I know that's not what you mean by a ghost, but there's that resonance that a character has still in my world. So I certainly believe it in that sense. Again, the flying saucers and the kind of whole issue of alien life. I've got this terrible, terrible feeling, you know, that we're alone. So I remember, I know it seems almost impossible, this vast cosmos. But I remember watching, there was a really good science program years ago, looking at the chance of intelligent life. And what they decided was, looking at all the possibilities at the vast scope of the universe, that it's probably the case that there is intelligent life, but only probably. And is that chance that there isn't? And if there is, why don't we know about it? Why haven't we heard the radio waves? Why is there just that terrifying silence out there? So my fear is, you know, it's just us, which is a huge burden, a huge responsibility. But I hope I'm wrong. Although I did, I read a couple of years ago, The Three Body Problem. Now, I'm not going to try to pronounce the name of the brilliant Chinese author. It's just embarrassing. Do you know about The Three Body Problem? I think they're in the process of making it into a huge Netflix series.
It was.
Beg your pardon?
I said, yes, it was.
Okay. There, his fundamental argument is that if there is life out there, then they're going to try to destroy us, just simply based on the logic of the fact that they might fear that we might destroy them. And so there's this huge impulse to get the first shot in to destroy the alien civilization. So maybe we should hope there's no one out there. If there is,
well, I thought that argument sounded like bullies thinking, "Oh my God, somebody killed us!" Well,
but just if you've got some responsible world government, and if there's, let's say, you encounter a world, and there's a 1 in 100 chance that they might want to destroy you, wouldn't it be the job of our responsible government to blow them up first? That's the argument behind the three-body problem, and that once you've got that, and if we think that, they're going to think that about us. So everyone's going to try and find the other civilizations and obliterate them. It's a cheery way to end our podcast, isn't it? with that prospect of utter annihilation. So that was a terribly serious response to the lovely question. I hope there's friendly aliens and I hope there are ghosts, but I've seen no evidence of either so far. Maybe I'll be one day and I'll come back and haunt your podcast.
No, you'll haunt another planet where there are aliens. You'll be like, oh my God, my afterlife is so rich. And so much to learn. Well, you know what? I'll ask a cheerier question. I'm fascinated by this idea of you're in an author's cricket club.
Yeah. Well, I don't know to what extent cricket as a sport means anything to you over there. Are you a cricket fan?
No, but in all fairness, every time I watch football, which is a huge American sport, my wife has to explain to me the rules again, and I'm still reading my book, and I look up once to tell me.
Well, I suppose, I mean, cricket's more like baseball, but it's like the international cricket match, they call a test match, they last 5 days. So you imagine one baseball match lasting 5 days and filled with arcane rules and rituals. But yeah, so it's a English sport played actually around the world, mainly the former British Empire. So India, Pakistan, Australia all play cricket. But it's, I suppose, like any great sport, like baseball. When you're playing cricket, you're in that moment. All that exists is this particular cricket match, hitting the ball, taking the catch. And it's a brilliant way of obliterating all those other problems in the world. You're not worrying about Putin in the Ukraine. You're not worrying about your own next book contract. All you're thinking about is, can I catch this ball? Or can I not get out to this bowler? So it's a wonderful way of escaping the world. Whilst also, again, the terrible thing about cricket is it's a game basically built around failure. So you're always on the brink of failure when you're playing cricket. So it's a kind of depressing game in that sense. And it's very seldom that you don't end a cricket match in a state of near total despair. But then also you have the camaraderie, the friendship to get you through. So it's a beautiful escape from cricket. So, from writing and the world, but also because it's a team full of authors. You're still in that world of literature. Although interestingly, when we're together, so everyone's a published author, we've got quite well-known historians and novelists, every genre you can imagine. But when we get together to talk over the match afterwards in the bar, what we talk about is not, on the whole, it's not books and literature, it's cricket. So we focus on that because that's our area of overlap. So there must be an American baseball writers team, you'd have thought.
Oh, yeah, there is. I just don't happen to be in one. So I was deeply with other authors, but not just talking about all the neurotic things that go into being an author, but focusing on well, apparently the absolute despair of your sport.
Yeah. Although, it's really interesting that baseball has produced many great novels, or at least two great novels that I know of, and lots of great literature. Whereas cricket, there are no great cricket novels, although lots of writers have played it. But there's something about cricket itself which doesn't open itself up to literature in the way that baseball seems to. I don't know why that is. It must be some kind of reason for it.
I think like a mythology. What's mythologizing. Your next, novel or two novels from now is going to have to be. Maybe there's a wide opening in the market. You're the guy.
Yeah, but I'm unlikely to crack America with my novel about cricket, though.
There are cricket fans here. I just don't happen to be one.
Oh, sure.
But like I say, it's not personal to against cricket. It's all sports that I have more or less an aversion to. My loss.
Well, sport ruins your life. You're better off without it.
This has been an absolute privilege and a pleasure. I know I could keep you talking just forever because I have so many more questions for you, but I have absolutely loved our time together. And I've got one last question for you. We'll end on this. And that is, if you could go back to the start of your career, middle of your career, wherever it would have made a significant difference and given yourself some advice that would have made easier your path and might make easier the path of everybody who's watching or listening to us now, what would you go back and tell yourself?
Oh, God, that's a brilliant question, almost impossible to answer. Because what I do believe is that just chance plays a role in your career as an author in the way that it doesn't with almost any other career. If you want to be a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer, the harder you work, the better you'll do. And with us, it's slightly different. You need that the right person on the right day who's looking for a book a bit like yours, and you've got a manuscript ready to go. So I'm not sure I could. It's maybe answering a slightly different question. Looking back, the time in my career that I actually most loved writing was back before I got published. When back then I was writing partly just for the love of it, partly just to express these ideas in my head, partly with a kind of vague hope about one day being published. And so back then, throughout my 20s really, and actually early 30s, then writing was a joy. It's my hobby. And I occasionally talk about writing as a hobby, and some writers don't like the idea of that. It devalues it. But a hobby is a thing you do purely for the love, not for the money. You don't do a hobby because you get paid for it. And so I almost want to go back to that time when writing was just a thing I did for the joy of it, rather than now where it's my job. I'm like a lawyer, as I said, going to the office every day and hammering out my work. Now trying to turn that vague woolly statement into a bit of advice, it's try and keep that joy, that sense that you're writing because you love writing, and that exuberant sensual enjoyment of language. Try and keep that child alive in you.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Where can esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media and all that good stuff?
Yeah, I tweet quite a lot. My home actually has been Facebook. So I spend far too much time on. I know Facebook is for the old guys like me, the old people. I use that as a kind of writing practice in a way. I'd often try out comic ideas or even still my terrible poems. I published a book called The Art of Failing a few years ago, which is based on my Facebook posts. Because when I sort of downloaded it all, I had something like 1 million words on Facebook. And so every day I tried to post something kind of quirky or funny or silly. So Facebook's probably the best way to get into my head. So friend me up on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. I'm too old for Instagram and TikTok or all those other things. I'm too old for that. But yeah, follow me on those.
I will send you a Facebook request shortly.
That'd be brilliant. That'd be brilliant.
We'll be friends for life.
Yeah. Can I just say how much I've enjoyed this talk? I'm sorry I've been kind of waffling and digressing too much, but it's been a joy chatting to you.
It's absolutely charming and a pleasure. And I think that esteemed audience has, in between the bits of comedy, sussed out some writing gold and learned a few things. And everybody's going to buy their copy of Dogs of the Deadlands available now. And as always, esteemed audience, for more information about me, but more importantly, for interviews with thousands of literary agents, authors, editors, book people, the world's best people, head to middlegradeninja.com, download your free copy of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, blurbed by the amazing Sir Richard Adams, and God willing, I'm alive. I'll see you next week.